I'm going to be a psychiatrist. Joan spoke with her usual breathy enthusiasm. We were drinking apple cider in the Belsize lounge. Oh, I said dryly. That's nice. I've had a long talk with Dr. Quinn, and she thinks it's perfectly possible. Dr. Quinn was Joan's psychiatrist, a bright, shrewd, single lady, and I often thought if I had been assigned to Dr. Quinn, I would still be in Kaplan, or more probably Weimark. Dr. Quinn had an abstract quality that appealed to Joan, but it gave me the polar chills. Joan chattered on about egos and ids, and I turned my mind to something else, to the brown, unwrapped package in my bottom drawer. I never talked about egos and ids with Dr. Nolan. I didn't know just what I talked about, really. I'm going to live out now. I tuned in on Joan then. Where? I demanded, trying to hide my envy. Dr. Nolan said my college would take me back for the second semester on her recommendation and Philomena Guinea's scholarship, but as the doctors vetoed my living with my mother in the interim, I was staying on at the asylum until the winter term began. Even so, I felt it unfair of Joan to beat me through the gates. Where? I persisted. They're not letting you live on your own, are they? Joan had only that week been given town privileges again. Oh, no, of course not. I'm living in Cambridge with Nurse Kennedy. Her roommates just got married, and she needs someone to share the apartment. Cheers. I raised my apple cider glass, and we clinked. In spite of my profound reservations, I thought I would always treasure Joan. It was as if we had been forced together by some overwhelming circumstance, like war or plague, and shared a world of our own. When are you leaving? On the first of the month. Nice. Joan grew wistful. You'll come visit me, won't you, Esther? Of course, but I thought, not likely. It hurts, I said. Is it supposed to hurt? Erwin didn't say anything. Then he said, sometimes it hurts. I had met Erwin on the steps of the Widner Library. I was standing at the top of the long flight, overlooking the red brick buildings that walled the snow-filled quad and preparing to catch the trolley back to the asylum, when a tall young man with a rather ugly and bespeckled but intelligent face came up and said, "Could you please tell me the time?" I glanced at my watch. 4:05. Then the man shifted his arms around the load of books he was carrying before him like a dinner tray and revealed a bony wrist. "Why, you've a watch yourself." The man looked ruefully at his watch. He lifted it and shook it by his ear. "Doesn't work." He smiled engagingly. "Where are you going?" I was about to say, "Back to the asylum," but the man looked promising, so I changed my mind. "Home. Would you like some coffee first?" I hesitated. I was due at the asylum for supper, and I didn't want to be late so close to being signed out of there for good. "A very small cup of coffee?" I decided to practice my new, normal personality on this man who, in the course of my hesitations, told me his name was Erwin and that he was a very well-paid professor of mathematics, so I said, "All right," and matching my stride to Erwin, strolled down the long, ice-encrusted flight at his side. It was only after seeing Erwin's study that I decided to seduce him. Erwin lived in a murky, comfortable basement apartment in one of the rundown streets of outer Cambridge and drove me there for a beer, he said, after 3 cups of bitter coffee in a student cafe. We sat in his study on stuffed brown leather chairs, surrounded by stacks of dusty, incomprehensible books with huge formulas inset artistically on the pages like poems. While I was sipping my first glass of beer, I've never really cared for cold beer in midwinter, but I accepted the glass to have something solid to hold on to. The doorbell rang. Erwin seemed embarrassed. I think it may be a lady. Erwin had a queer, old-world habit of calling women ladies. "Fine, fine," I gestured largely. "Bring her in." Erwin shook his head. "You would upset her." I smiled into my amber cylinder of cold beer. The doorbell rang again with a peremptory jab. Erwin sighed and rose to answer it. The minute he disappeared, I whipped into the bathroom and, concealed behind the dirty, aluminum-colored Venetian blind, watched Erwin's monkish face appear in the door crack. A large, bosomy Slavic lady in a bulky sweater of natural sheep's wool, purple slacks, high-heeled black overshoes with Persian lamb cuffs, and a matching toque, puffed white, inaudible words into the wintry air. Erwin's voice drifted back to me through the chilly hall. "I'm sorry, Olga. I'm working, Olga. No, I don't think so, Olga." All the while, the lady's red mouth moved, and the words translated to white smoke floated up among the branches of the naked lilac by the door. Then finally, "Perhaps, Olga. Goodbye, Olga." I admired the immense, step-like expanse of the lady's wool-clad bosom as she retreated a few inches from my eye down the creaking wooden stair, a sort of Siberian bitterness on her vivid lips. "I suppose you have lots and lots of affairs in Cambridge," I told Erwin cheerily, as I struck a snail with a pin in one of Cambridge's determinedly French restaurants. "I seem," Erwin admitted with a small, modest smile, "to get on with the ladies." I picked up my empty snail shell and drank the herb green juice. I had no idea if this was proper, but after months of wholesome, dull asylum diet, I was greedy for butter. I had called Dr. Nolan from a payphone at the restaurant and asked for permission to stay overnight in Cambridge with Joan. Of course, I had no idea whether Erwin would invite me back to his apartment after dinner or not, but I thought his dismissal of the Slavic lady, another professor's wife, looked promising. I tipped back my head and poured down a glass of Nuit St. George. "You do like wine," Erwin observed. "Only Nuit St. George. I imagine him with the dragon." Erwin reached for my hand. I felt the first man I slept with must be intelligent, so I would respect him. Erwin was a full professor at 26 and had the pale, hairless skin of a boy genius. I also needed somebody quite experienced to make up for my lack of it, and Erwin's ladies reassured me on this head. Then, to be on the safe side, I wanted somebody I didn't know and wouldn't go on knowing, a kind of impersonal priest-like official, as in the tales of tribal rites. By the end of the evening, I had no doubts about Erwin whatsoever. Ever since I'd learned about the corruption of Buddy Willard, my virginity weighed like a millstone around my neck. It had been of such enormous importance to me for so long that my habit was to defend it at all costs. I had been defending it for 5 years, and I was sick of it. It was only as Erwin swung me into his arms back at the apartment and carried me, wine-dazed and limp, into the pitch-black bedroom that I murmured, "You know, Erwin, I think I ought to tell you, I'm a virgin." Erwin laughed and flung me down on the bed. A few minutes later, an exclamation of surprise revealed that Erwin hadn't really believed me. I thought how lucky it was I had started practicing birth control during the day, because in my whiny state that night, I would never have bothered to perform the delicate and necessary operation. I lay, wrapped and naked, on Erwin's rough blanket, waiting for the miraculous change to make itself felt. But all I felt was sharp, startlingly bad pain. "It hurts," I said. "Is it supposed to hurt?" Erwin didn't say anything. Then he said, "Sometimes it hurts." After a little while, Erwin got up and went into the bathroom, and I heard the rushing of shower water. I wasn't sure if Erwin had done what he planned to do, or if my virginity had obstructed him in some way. I wanted to ask him if I was still a virgin, but I felt too unsettled. A warm liquid was seeping out between my legs. Tentatively, I reached down and touched it. When I held my hand up to the light streaming in from the bathroom, my fingers looked black. "Erwin," I said nervously, "bring me a towel." Erwin strolled back, a bath towel knotted around his waist, and tossed me a second, smaller towel. I pushed the towel between my legs and pulled it away almost immediately. It was half black with blood. "I'm bleeding," I announced, sitting up with a start. "Oh, that often happens," Erwin reassured me. "You'll be all right." Then the stories of blood-stained bridal sheets and capsules of red ink bestowed on already deflowered brides floated back to me. I wondered how much I would bleed and lay down, nursing the towel. It occurred to me that the blood was my answer. I couldn't possibly be a virgin anymore. I smiled into the dark. I felt part of a great tradition. Surreptitiously, I applied a fresh section of white towel to my wound, thinking that as soon as the bleeding stopped, I would take the late trolley back to the asylum. I wanted to brood over my new condition in perfect peace, but the towel came away black and dripping. "I think I better go home," I said faintly. "Surely not so soon." "Yes, I think I better." I asked if I could borrow Erwin's towel and packed it between my thighs as a bandage. Then I pulled on my sweaty clothes. Erwin offered to drive me home, but I didn't see how I could let him drive me to the asylum, so I dug in my pocketbook for Joan's address. Erwin knew the street and went out to start the car. I was too worried to tell him I was still bleeding. I kept hoping every minute that it would stop. But as Erwin drove me through the barren, snow-banked streets, I felt the warm seepage let itself through the dam of the towel and my skirt and onto the car seat. As we slowed, cruising by house after lit house, I thought how fortunate it was I had not discarded my virginity while living at college or at home, where such concealment would have been impossible. Joan opened the door with an expression of glad surprise. Erwin kissed my hand and told Joan to take good care of me. I shut the door and leaned back against it, feeling the blood drain from my face in one spectacular flush.
"Why, Esther," Joan said, "what on earth's the matter?"
I wondered when Joan would notice the blood trickling down my legs and oozing stickily into each black patent leather shoe. I thought I could be dying from a bullet wound, and Joan would still stare through me with her blank eyes, expecting me to ask for a cup of coffee and a sandwich. "Is that nurse here?" "No, she's on night duty at Kaplan." "Good." I made a little bitter grin as another soak of blood let itself through the drenched padding and started the tedious journey into my shoes. "I mean, bad."
"You look funny," Joan said.
"You better get a doctor."
"Why?"
"Quick."
But she still hadn't noticed anything.
I bent down with a brief grunt and slipped off one of my winter-cracked black Bloomingdale shoes. I held the shoe up before Joan's enlarged, pebbly eyes, tilted it, and watched her take in the stream of blood that cascaded onto the beige rug.
"My God, what is it?"
"I'm hemorrhaging." Joan half-led, half-dragged me to the sofa and made me lie down. Then she propped some pillows under my blood-stained feet. Then she stood back and demanded, "Who was that man?" For one crazy minute, I thought Joan would refuse to call a doctor until I confessed the whole story of my evening with Erwin, and that after my confession, she would still refuse as a sort of punishment. But then I realized that she honestly took my explanation at face value, that my going to bed with Erwin was utterly incomprehensible to her, and his appearance a mere prick to her pleasure at my arrival. "Oh, somebody," I said, with a flabby gesture of dismissal. Another pulse of blood released itself, and I contracted my stomach muscles in alarm. "Get a towel." Joan went out and came back almost immediately with a pile of towels and sheets. Like a prompt nurse, she peeled back my blood-wet clothes, drew a quick breath as she arrived at the original royal red towel, and applied a fresh bandage. I lay, trying to slow the beating of my heart as every beat pushed forth another gush of blood. I remembered a worrisome course in the Victorian novel where woman after woman died, palely and nobly, in torrents of blood after a difficult childbirth. Perhaps Erwin had injured me in some awful, obscure way, and all the while I lay there on Joan's sofa, I was really dying. Joan pulled up an Indian hassock and began to dial down the long list of Cambridge doctors. The first number didn't answer. Joan began to explain my case to the second number, which did answer, but then broke off and said, "I see," and hung up. "What's the trouble?" "He'll only come for regular customers or emergencies. It's Sunday." I tried to lift my arm and look at my watch, but my hand was a rock at my side and wouldn't budge. Sunday. The doctor's paradise.
doctors at country clubs, doctors at the seaside, doctors with mistresses, doctors with wives, doctors in church, doctors in yachts, doctors everywhere, resolutely being people, not doctors. "For God's sake," I said, "tell them it's an emergency." The third number didn't answer, and at the fourth, the party hung up the minute Joan mentioned it was about a period. Joan began to cry. "Look, Joan," I said painstakingly, "call up the local hospital. Tell them it's an emergency. They'll have to take me." Joan brightened and dialed a fifth number. The emergency service promised her a staff doctor would attend to me if I could come to the ward. Joan called a taxi. Joan insisted on riding with me. I clasped my fresh padding of towels with a sort of desperation as the cabbie, impressed by the address Joan gave him, cut corner after corner in the dawn-pale streets and drew up with a great squeal of tires at the emergency ward entrance. I left Joan to pay the driver and hurried into the empty, glaring-lit room. A nurse bustled out from behind a white screen. In a few swift words, I managed to tell her the truth about my predicament before Joan came in the door, blinking and wide-eyed as a myopic owl. The emergency ward doctor strolled out then, and I climbed, with a nurse's help, onto the examining table. The nurse whispered to the doctor, and the doctor nodded and began unpacking the bloody towel. I felt his fingers start to probe, and Joan stood, rigid as a soldier, at my side, holding my hand. For my sake or hers, I couldn't tell. "Ouch," I winced at a particularly bad jab. The doctor whistled.
"You're one in a million."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean it's one in a million it happens to like this."
The doctor spoke in a low, curt voice to the nurse, and she hurried to a side table and brought back some rolls of gauze and silver instruments. "I can see," the doctor bent down, "exactly where the trouble is coming from. But can you fix it?" The doctor laughed. "Oh, I can fix it, all right." I was roused by a tap on my door. It was past midnight in the asylum, quiet as death. I couldn't imagine who would still be up. "Come in." I switched on the bedside light. The door clicked open, and Dr. Quinn's brisk, dark head appeared in the crack. I looked at her with surprise, because although I knew who she was and often passed her with a brief nod in the asylum hall, I never spoke to her at all. Now she said, "Miss Greenwood, may I come in a minute?" I nodded. Dr. Quinn stepped into the room, shutting the door quietly behind her. She was wearing one of her navy blue, immaculate suits with a plain, snow-white blouse showing in the V of the neck. "I'm sorry to bother you, Miss Greenwood, and especially at this time of night, but I thought you might be able to help us out about Joan." For a minute, I wondered if Dr. Quinn was going to blame me for Joan's return to the asylum. I still wasn't sure how much Joan knew after our trip to the emergency ward. But a few days later, she had come back to live in Belsize, retaining, however, the freest of town privileges. "I'll do what I can," I told Dr. Quinn. Dr. Quinn sat down on the edge of my bed with a grave face. "We would like to find out where Joan is. We thought you might have an idea." Suddenly, I wanted to disassociate myself from Joan completely. "I don't know," I said coldly. "Isn't she in her room?" It was well after the Belsize curfew hour. "No. Joan had a permit to go to a movie in town this evening, and she's not back yet."
"Who was she with?"
"She was alone." Dr. Quinn paused. "Have you any idea where she might be likely to spend the night?"
"Surely she'll be back.
Something must have held her up." But I didn't see what could have held Joan up in tame night Boston. Dr. Quinn shook her head. "The last trolley went by an hour ago."
"Maybe she'll come by taxi."
Dr. Quinn sighed. "Have you tried the Kennedy girl?" I went on. "Where Joan used to live?" Dr. Quinn nodded. "Her family?" "Oh, she'd never go there. But we've tried them too." Dr. Quinn lingered a minute, as if she could sniff out some clue in the still room. Then she said, "Well, we'll do what we can," and left. I turned out the light and tried to drop back to sleep, but Joan's face floated before me, bodiless and smiling, like the face of the Cheshire Cat. I even thought I heard her voice, rustling and hushing through the dark, and then I realized it was only the night wind in the asylum trees.
Another tap woke me in the frost-gray dawn. This time I opened the door myself. Facing me was Dr. Quinn. She stood at attention like a frail drill sergeant, but her outlines seemed curiously smudged.
"I thought you should know," Dr. Quinn said. "Joan has been found."
Dr. Quinn's use of the passive slowed my blood.
"Where?"
"In the woods, by the frozen ponds." I opened my mouth, but no words came out.
"One of the orderlies found her," Dr. Quinn continued, "just now, coming to work."
"She's not
dead," said Dr. Quinn. "I'm afraid she's hanged herself."
A fresh fall of snow blanketed the asylum grounds. Not a Christmas sprinkle, but a man-high January deluge. The sort that snuffs out schools and offices and churches and leaves, for a day or more, a pure blank sheet in place of memo pads, date books, and calendars. In a week, if I passed my interview with the board of directors, Philomena Guinea's large black car would drive me west and deposit me at the wrought iron gates of my college. The heart of winter. Massachusetts would be sunk in a marble calm. I pictured the snowflakey Grandma Moses villages, the reaches of swampland rattling with dried cattails, the ponds where frog and hornpout dreamed in a sheath of ice, and the shivering woods. But under the deceptively clean and level slate, the topography was the same, and instead of San Francisco or Europe or Mars, I would be learning the old landscape, brook and hill and tree. In one way, it seemed a small thing, starting after a 6 months lapse where I had so vehemently left off. Everybody would know about me, of course. Dr. Nolan had said, quite bluntly, that a lot of people would treat me gingerly or even avoid me like a leper with a warning bell. My mother's face floated to mind, a pale, reproachful moon at her last and first visit to the asylum since my 20th birthday. A daughter in an asylum. I had done that to her. Still, she had obviously decided to forgive me. "We'll take up where we left off, Esther," she had said with her sweet, martyr's smile. "We'll act as if all this were a bad dream. A bad dream." To the person in the bell jar, blank and stopped as a dead baby, the world itself is the bad dream. A bad dream. I remembered everything. I remembered the cadavers and Doreen and the story of the fig tree and Marco's diamond and the sailor on the common and Dr. Gordon's wall-eyed nurse and the broken thermometers and the Negro with his two kinds of beans and the 20 pounds I gained on insulin and the rock that bulged between sky and sea like a gray skull. Maybe forgetfulness, like a kind of snow, should numb and cover them. But they were part of me. They were my landscape. "A man to see you." The smiling, snow-capped nurse poked her head in through the door, and for a confused second, I thought I really was back in college. And this spruce white furniture, this white view over trees and hills, an improvement on my old room's nicked chairs and desk and outlook over the bald quad. "A man to see you," the girl on watch had said on the dormitory phone. What was there about us, in bell size, so different from the 20 girls playing bridge and gossiping and studying in the college to which I would return? Those girls, too, sat under bell jars of a sort. "Come in," I called. And Buddy Willard, khaki cap in hand, stepped into the room. "Well, Buddy," I said.
"Well, Esther."
We stood there looking at each other. I waited for a touch of emotion, the faintest glow. Nothing. Nothing but a great, amiable boredom. Buddy's khaki jacketed shape seemed small and unrelated to me as the brown posts he had stood against that day a year ago at the bottom of the ski run. "How did you get here?" I asked finally. "Mother's car. And all this snow?"
"Well," Buddy grinned, "I'm stuck outside in a drift. The hill was too much for me. Is there any place I can borrow a shovel?"
We can get a shovel from one of the groundsmen.
Good. Buddy turned to go.
Wait, I'll come and help you.
Buddy looked at me then, and in his eyes I saw a flicker of strangeness, the same compound of curiosity and wariness I had seen in the eyes of the Christian Scientist and my old English teacher and the Unitarian minister who used to visit me.
Oh, Buddy, I laughed. I'm all right. Oh, I know, Esther, Buddy said hastily.
It's you who oughtn't to dig out cars, Buddy, not me. And Buddy did let me do most of the work. The car had skidded on the glassy hill up to the asylum and backed with one wheel over the rim of the drive into a steep drift. The sun emerged from its gray shrouds of cloud, shone with a summer brilliance on the untouched slopes. Pausing in my work to overlook that pristine expanse, I felt the same profound thrill it gives me to see trees and grassland waist-high under floodwater, as if the usual order of the world had shifted slightly and entered a new phase. I was grateful for the car and the snowdrift. It kept Buddy from asking me what I knew he was going to ask, and what he finally did ask in a low, nervous voice at the Belsize afternoon tea. Dee Dee was eyeing us like an envious cat over the rim of her teacup. After Joan's death, Dee Dee had been moved to Weimark for a while, but now she was among us once more. I've been wondering, Buddy set his cup in the saucer with an awkward clatter. What have you been wondering?
I've been wondering. I mean, I thought you might be able to tell me something.
Buddy met my eyes, and I saw for the first time how he had changed. Instead of the old, sure smile that flashed on easily and frequently as a photographer's bulb, his face was grave, even tentative, the face of a man who often does not get what he wants. I'll tell you if I can, Buddy. Do you think there's something in me that drives women crazy? I couldn't help myself. I burst out laughing, maybe because of the seriousness of Buddy's face and the common meaning of the word crazy in a sentence like that.
I mean, Buddy pushed on. I dated Joan, and then you. And first you went, and then Joan.
With one finger, I nudged a cake crumb into a drop of wet brown tea.
Of course you didn't do it,
I heard Dr. Nolan say. I had come to her about Joan, and it was the only time I remember her sounding angry. Nobody did it. She did it. And then Dr. Nolan told me how the best psychiatrists have suicide among their patients, and how they, if anybody, should be held responsible, but how they, on the contrary, do not hold themselves responsible.
You had nothing to do with us, Buddy.
You're sure?
Absolutely.
Well, Buddy breathed. I'm glad of that. And he drained his tea like a tonic medicine.
I hear you're leaving us.
I fell into step beside Valerie in the little nurse-supervised group. Only if the doctors say yes. I have my interview tomorrow. The packed snow creaked underfoot, and everywhere I could hear a musical trickle and drip as the noon sun thawed icicles and snow crusts that would glaze again before nightfall. The shadows of the massed black pines were lavender in that bright light, and I walked with Valerie a while, down the familiar labyrinth of shoveled asylum paths. Doctors and nurses and patients passing on adjoining paths seemed to be moving on casters, cut off at the waist by the piled snow. Interviews, Valerie snorted. They're nothing. If they're going to let you out, they let you out.
I hope so.
In front of Kaplan, I said goodbye to Valerie's calm, snow-maiden face, behind which so little, bad or good, could happen, and walked on alone, my breath coming in white puffs even in that sun-filled air. Valerie's last cheerful cry had been, "So long. Be seeing you." Not if I know it, I thought. But I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure at all. How did I know that someday, at college in Europe, somewhere, anywhere, the bell jar, with its stifling distortions, wouldn't descend again? And hadn't Buddy said, as if to revenge himself for my digging out the car and his having to stand by, "I wonder who you'll marry now, Esther."
What? I'd said,
shoveling snow up onto a mound and blinking against the stinging back shower of loose flakes. I wonder who you'll marry now, Esther. Now you've been, and Buddy's gesture encompassed the hill, the pines, and the severe snow-gabled buildings breaking up the rolling landscape. Here. And of course, I didn't know who would marry me now I'd been where I'd been. I didn't know at all. I have a bill here, Erwin. I spoke quietly into the mouthpiece of the asylum payphone in the main hall of the administration building. At first, I suspected the operator at her switchboard might be listening, but she just went on plugging and unplugging her little tubes without batting an eye. Yes, Erwin said. It's a bill for $20 for emergency attention on a certain date in December and a checkup a week thereafter. Yes, Erwin said. The hospital says they are sending me the bill because there was no answer to the bill they sent you. All right, I'm writing a check now. I'm writing them a blank check. Erwin's voice altered subtly. When am I going to see you? Do you really want to know? Very much. Never, I said, and hung up with a resolute click. I wondered briefly if Erwin would send his check to the hospital after that, and then I thought, of course he will. He's a mathematics professor. He won't want to leave any loose ends. I felt unaccountably weak-kneed and relieved. Erwin's voice had meant nothing to me. This was the first time since our first and last meeting that I had spoken with him, and I was reasonably sure it would be the last. Erwin had absolutely no way of getting in touch with me, except by going to Nurse Kennedy's flat, and after Joan's death, Nurse Kennedy had moved somewhere else and left no trace. I was perfectly free. Joan's parents invited me to the funeral. I had been, Mrs. Gilling said, one of Joan's best friends. You don't have to go, you know, Dr. Nolan told me. You can always write and say I said it would be better not to. I'll go, I said, and I did go. And all during the simple funeral service, I wondered what I thought I was burying. At the altar, the coffin loomed in its snow pallor of flowers, the black shadow of something that wasn't there. The faces in the pews around me were waxen with candlelight, and pine boughs, left over from Christmas, sent up a sepulchral incense in the cold air. Beside me, Jody's cheeks bloomed like good apples, and here and there in the little congregation, I recognized other faces of other girls from college and my hometown who had known Joan. Dee Dee and Nurse Kennedy bent their handkerchiefed heads in a front pew. Then, behind the coffin and the flowers and the face of the minister and the faces of the mourners, I saw the rolling lawns of our town cemetery, knee-deep in snow now, with the tombstones rising out of it like smokeless chimneys. There would be a black, 6-foot-deep gap hacked in the hard ground. That shadow would marry this shadow, and the peculiar yellowish soil of our locality seal the wound in the whiteness, and yet another snowfall erased the traces of newness in Joan's grave. I took a deep breath and listened to the old brag of my heart. I am, I am, I am. The doctors were having their weekly board meeting. Old business, new business, admissions, dismissals, and interviews. Leafing blindly through a tatty National Geographic in the asylum library, I waited my turn. Patients with accompanying nurses made their rounds of the stocked shelves, conversing in low tones with the asylum librarian, an alumna of the asylum herself. Glancing at her, myopic, spinsterish, effaced, I wondered how she knew she had graduated at all, and, unlike her clients, was whole and well. Don't be scared, Dr. Nolan had said. I'll be there, and the rest of the doctors you know, and some visitors, and Dr. Vining, the head of all the doctors, will ask you a few questions, and then you can go. But in spite of Dr. Nolan's reassurances, I was scared to death. I had hoped, at my departure, I would feel sure and knowledgeable about everything that lay ahead. After all, I had been analyzed. Instead, all I could see were question marks.
I kept shooting impatient glances at the closed boardroom door. My stocking seams were straight, my black shoes cracked but polished, and my red wool suit flamboyant as my plans. Something old, something new. But I wasn't getting married. There ought, I thought, to be a ritual for being born twice. Patched, retreaded, and approved for the road. I was trying to think of an appropriate one when Dr. Nolan appeared from nowhere and touched me on the shoulder. All right, Esther. I rose and followed her to the open door. Pausing for a brief breath on the threshold, I saw the silver-haired doctor who had told me about the rivers and the pilgrims on my first day, and the pocked, cadaverous face of Miss Huey, and eyes I thought I had recognized over white masks. The eyes and the faces all turned themselves toward me, and guiding myself by them, as by a magical thread, I stepped into the room. Sylvia Plath, A Biographical Note by Lois Ames. The Bell Jar was first published in London in January 1963 by William Heinemann Limited, under the pseudonym Victoria Lucas. Sylvia Plath had adopted the pen name for publication of her first novel because she questioned its literary value and did not believe it was a serious work. She was also worried about the pain publication might cause to the many people close to her whose personalities she had distorted and lightly disguised in the book. The central themes of Sylvia Plath's early life are the basis for The Bell Jar. She was born in 1932 in Massachusetts and spent her early childhood years in Winthrop, a seaside town close to Boston. Her mother's parents were Austrian. Her father, a distinguished professor of biology at Boston University and an internationally known authority on bees, had emigrated to the States from Poland as an adolescent. She had one brother, 2.5 years younger. A radical change occurred in Sylvia's life when she was 8. In November 1940, her father died after a long, difficult illness, and her mother and grandparents moved the family inland to the town of Wellesley, a conservative, upper-middle-class suburb of Boston. While the grandmother assumed the care of the household, Mrs. Plath taught students in the Medical Secretarial Training Program at Boston University, commuting each day, and the grandfather worked as maitre d'hôtel at the Brookline Country Club, where he lived during the week. Sylvia and her brother attended the local public schools. "I went to public schools," she wrote later, "genuinely public. Everyone went." At an early age, she began to write poems and to draw in pen and ink, and to collect prizes with her first publication of each. By the time she was 17, her interest in writing had become disciplined and controlled. Publication, however, did not come easily. She had submitted 45 pieces to the magazine 17 before her first short story, "And Summer Will Not Come Again," was published in the August 1950 issue. A poem, "Bitter Strawberries," a sardonic comment on war, was accepted and published in the same month by the Christian Science Monitor. In her high school yearbook, The Wellesleyan, the girl who later described herself as a rabid teenage pragmatist was pictured. Warm smile, energetic worker, bumble boogie piano specialist, clever with chalk and paints, weekends at Williams, those fully packed sandwiches, future writer, those rejection slips from 17, oh, for a license. In September 1950, Sylvia entered Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, the largest women's college in the world. She went on scholarship, one from the Wellesley Smith Club and one endowed by Olive Higgins Prouty, the novelist and author of Stella Dallas, later a friend and patron. These were the years in which Sylvia wrote poetry on a precise schedule, circled words in the red leather thesaurus which had belonged to her father, maintained a detailed journal, kept a diligent scrapbook, and studied with concentration. Highly successful as a student, she was also elected to class and college offices. She became a member of the editorial board of The Smith Review, went for weekends to men's colleges, and published stories and poems in 17. But at the time, she wrote in a letter, "For the few little outward successes I may seem to have, there are acres of misgiving and self-doubt." Of this period, a friend later said, it was as if Sylvia couldn't wait for life to come to her. She rushed out to greet it, to make things happen. As she became increasingly conscious of herself as a woman, the conflict between the lifestyle of a poet intellectual and that of a wife and mother became a central preoccupation. And she wrote, "It's quite amazing how I've gone around for most of my life as in the rarefied atmosphere under a bell jar." In August 1951, she won Mademoiselle magazine's fiction contest with a short story, Sunday at the Mintons. And in the following year, her junior year in college, Sylvia was awarded 2 Smith Poetry Prizes and was elected to Phi Beta Kappa and to Alpha, the Smith College Honorary Society for the Arts. Then in the summer of 1952, she was chosen to be a guest editor in Mademoiselle's College Board Contest. In her scrapbook, she described the beginning of that month in New York in the breathy style of the magazine. After being one of the 2 national winners of Mademoiselle's fiction contest, $500, last August, I felt that I was coming home again when I won a guest editorship representing Smith and took a train to New York City for a salaried month working, hatted and heeled, in Miles' air-conditioned Madison Avenue offices. Fantastic, fabulous, and all other inadequate adjectives go to describe the 4 gala and chaotic weeks I worked as guest managing ed. Living in luxury at the Barbizon, I edited, met celebrities, was feted and feasted by a galaxy of UN delegates, simultaneous interpreters and artists. An almost unbelievable merry-go-round month. This Smith Cinderella met idols Vance Borgeli, Paul Engel, Elizabeth Bowen, wrote article via correspondence with 5 handsome young male poet teachers. The poets were Alistair Reed, Anthony Hecht, Richard Wilbur, George Steiner, and William Burford, whose pictures were accompanied by biographical notes and comments on poets and poetry. After 230 odd pages of advertising, the bulk of the August 1953 college issue was introduced by Sylvia as guest managing editor with Mademoiselle's Last Word on College 53, under a vapid picture of the guest editors holding hands in star formation, dressed alike in tartan skirts with matching Eton caps and open-mouthed smiles, she wrote. "We're stargazers this season, bewitched by an atmosphere of evening blue. Foremost in the fashion constellation, we spot Mademoiselle's own tartan, the astronomic versatility of sweaters, and men, men, men. We've even taken the shirts off their backs. Focusing our telescope on college news around the globe, we debate and deliberate. Issues illuminated, academic freedom, the sorority controversy, our much-labeled and libeled generation. From our favorite field, stars of the first magnitude shed a bright influence on our plans for jobs and futures. Although horoscopes for our ultimate orbits aren't in yet, we guest eds are counting on a favorable forecast with this send-off from Mademoiselle, the star of the campus." No doubt she was more pleased with page 358. Mademoiselle finally published Mad Girl's Love Song, My Favorite Villanelle. Mad Girl's Love Song, A Villanelle, by Sylvia Plath, Smith College, 54. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I lift my lids and all is born again. I think I made you up inside my head. The stars go waltzing out in blue and red. An arbitrary blackness gallops in. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I dreamed that you bewitched me into bed and sung me moonstruck, kissed me quite insane. I think I made you up inside my head. God topples from the sky, hell's fires fade. Exit seraphim and Satan's men. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I fancied you'd return the way you said, but I grow old and I forget your name. I think I made you up inside my head. I should have loved a thunderbird instead. At least when spring comes, they roar back again. I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. I think I made you up inside my head." That summer, too, Harper's Magazine paid $100 for 3 poems which Sylvia identified as first professional earnings.
Later, assessing these bubbling achievements, she wrote, "All in all, I felt upborne on a wave of creative, social, and financial success. The six-month crash, however, was to come." There were the events which took place in her life in the summer and autumn of 1953, at the time of the electrocution of the Rosenbergs, at the time when Senator Joseph McCarthy was forcing his power, at the beginning of the Eisenhower presidency. These were the events which Sylvia Plath reconstructed in The Bell Jar. Years later, she described the book she wanted to write. The pressures of the fashion magazine world, which seems increasingly superficial and artificial, the return home to the dead summer world of a suburb of Boston. Here, the cracks in her, the heroine Esther Greenwood's nature, which had been held together, as it were, by the surrounding pressures of New York, widen and gape alarmingly. More and more, her warped view of the world around her, her own vacuous domestic life and that of her neighbors, seems the one right way of looking at things. For Sylvia, then came electroshock therapy, and finally her well-publicized disappearance, subsequent discovery, and consequent hospitalization for psychotherapy and more shock treatment. She wrote, "A time of darkness, despair, disillusion, so black only as the inferno of the human mind can be. Symbolic death and numb shock, then the painful agony of slow rebirth and psychic regeneration." Subsequently, Sylvia returned to Smith College and reconquered old Broncos that threw me for a loop last year. At the beginning of the next summer, she wrote that a semester of reconstruction ends with an infinitely more solid, if less flashingly spectacular, flourish than last year's. By the end of the next academic year, she had sold more poems, earned additional prizes, and written her long paper for English honors on the double personality in Dostoevsky's novels. In June 1955, she graduated from Smith College, summa cum laude, with the prospect of an English Fulbright year in Newnham College at Cambridge University. There, Sylvia met the British poet Ted Hughes, whom she married in London on June 16, 1956, Bloomsday. Sylvia's Fulbright was renewed, and after a vacation in Spain, Ted and Sylvia lived in Cambridge for another year. Then, in the spring of 1957, they moved to the United States, where Sylvia was assessed by her colleagues as one of the two or three finest instructors ever to appear in the English department at Smith College. It is probable that Sylvia already had a version of The Bell Jar in her trunks when she returned to the States, but she was concentrating on poetry and on teaching. In June 1958, she applied for a Eugene F. Saxton Memorial Fellowship to complete her book of poems. The Saxton Fellowship had been established to honor an outstanding editor of Harper and Brothers. The trust, at the discretion of the trustees, gave outright grants of money to writers for living expenses. Agreement of all three trustees was necessary to make the grant, and one of them, who called the sample poems Beyond Reproach, noted that, "In looking over Mrs. Hughes' history, I see that she has had valuable awards dropped into her lap during most of her adult life. Perhaps it would not do her any real harm to continue her work for a while as a teacher in a fine college. My impulse is rejection, though I think the quality of her work entitles her to serious consideration." In October 1958, the application was rejected with a special letter from the secretary to the trustees, who wanted Mrs. Hughes to know that "your application aroused more than ordinary interest. The talent, which is marked, was not a matter for dispute, but rather the nature of the project." Meanwhile, the Hugheses had moved to a small apartment on Beacon Hill, living on a shoestring for a year in Boston, writing to see what we could do. Sylvia had made the difficult decision to give up teaching and to discard an academic plan for which she had been groomed since childhood in exchange for a less certain existence, but one which she hoped would give her more time to write. However, as the year progressed and her book of poems was repeatedly submitted and rejected under ever-changing titles, she wrote, "Nothing stinks like a pile of unpublished writing, which remark I guess shows I still don't have a pure motive. Oh, it's such fun, I just can't stop. Who cares if it's published or read about writing? I still want to see it finally ritualized in print." In December 1959, Ted and Sylvia returned to England to live. In April 1960, their first child, Frida, was born. At last, Sylvia's book of poetry, The Colossus, was accepted for fall publication by William Heinemann Limited. Subsequently, Sylvia suffered a miscarriage, then an appendectomy, and then became pregnant again. On May 1, 1961, she again applied for a Eugene F. Saxton Fellowship, this time in order to finish a novel which she described as 1/6 completed, about 50 pages. On the application, Sylvia had asked for money to cover babysitter or nanny at about $5 a day, 6 days a week for a year, $1,560. Rent of study at about $10 a week, $520 for a year. Total, $2,080. At present, I am living in a two-room flat with my husband and a year-old baby and having to work part-time to meet living expenses. To a friend, she wrote that she was over one-third through a novel about a college girl building up for and going through a nervous breakdown. She wrote, I have been wanting to do this for 10 years, but had a terrible block about writing a novel. Then suddenly, in beginning negotiations with a New York publisher for an American edition of my poems, the dikes broke and I stayed awake all night, seized by fearsome excitement, saw how it should be done, started the next day, and go every morning to my borrowed study as to an office and belt out more of it. In the summer, the Hugheses moved to Devon to live in a thatch-roofed country house. And on November 6, 1961, the secretary to the Saxton trustees wrote that they had voted to give her a grant in the amount of $2,080, the sum you suggested. Sylvia replied, I was very happy to receive your good letter today telling about the Saxton Fellowship. I certainly do plan to go ahead with the novel, and the award comes at a particularly helpful time to free me to do so. On January 17, 1962, a son, Nicholas, was born. The days were divided among the babies, housework, and writing, but on February 10, 1962, Sylvia punctually delivered her first quarterly report on the progress of her novel to the Saxton trustees. During the past 3 months, the novel has progressed very satisfactorily, according to my drafted schedule. I have worked through several rough drafts to a final version of chapters 5-8, completing a total of 105 pages of the novel in all, and have outlined in detail chapters 9 through 12. Then she gave in detail the plans for the bell jar. Although the novel was going well, Sylvia complained to a friend that she felt she was doing little work. A couple of poems I like a year looks like a lot when they come out, but in fact are points of satisfaction separated by large vacancies. On May 1, 1962, in the next quarterly report to the Saxton trustees, she wrote, The novel is getting on very well, and according to schedule. I have completed chapters 9 through 12, pages 106 to 166, and projected in detailed outline the next lap of the book. By June 1962, she could tell a friend, I'm writing again, really writing. I'd like you to see some of my new poems. She had begun the Ariel poems and was confident enough to want to show them, to have them read, to read them aloud. These poems were different. Her husband has written that Tulips was the first sign of what was on its way. She wrote this poem without her usual studies over the thesaurus and at top speed as one might write an urgent letter. From then on, all her poems were written in this way. On August 1, 1962, Sylvia sent her final progress report to the Saxton trustees. The novel is rounding out now, shaping up pretty much as planned, and I have completed chapters 13 through 16, pages 167 to 221, and am hoping the last lap goes as well. After a vacation in Ireland, Sylvia and Ted decided to separate for a while. The summer had been difficult. She had suffered repeated attacks of flu accompanied by high fever. Another winter in Devon seemed impossible. She began to commute to London, where she was getting work with the BBC and hunting for a flat. The manuscript of The Bell Jar had been sent to the trustees of the Saxton Fellowship in the States, and Heinemann had accepted the novel in England and was setting it into type. A few days before Christmas, Sylvia moved herself and the children to London, where she had signed a 5-year lease on a flat. A small miracle happened. I'd been to Yates Tower at Ballylee while in Ireland, and thought it the most beautiful and peaceful place in the world. Then, walking desolately around my beloved Primrose Hill in London and brooding on the hopelessness of ever finding a flat, I passed Yates's home with its blue plaque, Yates Lived Here, which I'd often passed and longed to live in. A signboard was up, flats to rent. I flew to the agent. By a miracle you can only know if you've ever tried to flat hunt in London, I was first to apply. I am here on a 5-year lease, and it is utter heaven. And it's Yates's house, which right now means a lot to me. Sylvia took the finding of Yates's house for a sign. She told a friend that when she went out to look for flats that day, she had known she would find it. And so, with that confirmation, she began to make plans with energetic assurance. She was working on a new novel, and the Ariel poems were continuing to flow. She told another friend that she thought of The Bell Jar as an autobiographical apprentice work, which I had to write in order to free myself from the past. But the new novel, about more recent events in her life, she regarded as strong, powerful, and urgent. When The Bell Jar was published in January 1963, Sylvia was distressed by the reviews, although another reader, not the author, and not under the same sorts of stress, might have interpreted the critic's view of the novel far differently. Lawrence Lerner in The Listener wrote, "There are criticisms of America that the neurotic can make as well as anyone, perhaps better, and Miss Lucas makes them brilliantly." The Times Literary Supplement observed that the author can certainly write, and went on to say that if she can learn to shape as well as she imagines, she may write an extremely good book. In The New Statesman, Robert Taubman called The Bell Jar the first feminine novel in a Salinger mood. In 1970, Ariella Plath, her mother, wrote a letter to Sylvia's editor at Harper & Row in New York about the anticipated publication of the first American edition of The Bell Jar. "I realize that no explanation of the why of personal suffering that this publication here, publication of The Bell Jar in the United States, will create in the lives of several people, nor any appeal on any other ground is going to stop this. So I shall waste neither my time nor yours in pointing out the inevitable repercussions. I do want to tell you of one of the last conversations I had with my daughter in early July 1962, just before her personal world fell apart. Sylvia told me of the pressure she was under in fulfilling her obligation to the Eugene Saxton Fund. As you know, she had been given a grant by this fund to enable her to write a novel. In the space of time allotted, she had a miscarriage, an appendectomy, and had given birth to her second child, Nicholas. What I've done, I remember her saying, is throw together events from my own life, fictionalizing to add color. It's a potboiler, really, but I think it will show how isolated a person feels when he is suffering a breakdown. I've tried to picture my world and the people in it as seen through the distorting lens of a bell jar." Then she went on to say, "My second book will show that same world as seen through the eyes of health. Practically every character in The Bell Jar represents someone, often in caricature, who Sylvia loved. Each person had given freely of time, thought, affection, and in one case, financial help during those agonizing 6 months of breakdown in 1953. As this book stands by itself, it represents the basest ingratitude. That was not the basis of Sylvia's personality. It was the reason she became so frightened when, at the time of publication, the book was widely read and showed signs of becoming a success. Sylvia wrote her brother that this must never be published in the United States. The very title, The Bell Jar, should imply what Sylvia told me, and that is what the astute reader should infer." It was the coldest winter in London since 1813-1814. Light and heat went off at unannounced intervals. Pipes froze. She had applied, and her name was on the list, but a telephone had not yet been installed. Each morning before the children woke at 8, Sylvia worked on the Ariel poems. Here, the sense of human experience was horrid and ungovernable. The sense of all relationships as puppet-like and meaningless had come to dominate her imagination. Yet she wrote with intensity, convinced that what she was now writing could be said by no one else. Always there was the need to be practical, to find time for the deliberate expression of anguish. Sylvia wrote, "I feel like a very efficient tool or weapon, used and in demand from moment to moment." She had seen a doctor who had prescribed sedatives and had arranged for her to consult a psychotherapist. She wrote for an appointment and had also written to her former psychiatrist in Boston. A recurrent problem of sinus infection developed.
She had fired her au pair girl and was waiting for a replacement to help with the babes mornings so I can write. Nights are no good. I'm so flat by then that all I can cope with is music and brandy and water. In spite of the help of friends and anticipation of spring, she was to return to the house in Devon around May Day. She was despairing and ill. But the poems continued to come, even in the last week of her life, several extraordinary poems. To those around her, it appeared that she had not given up. Frequently, she seemed bright, cheerful, full of hope. However, on the morning of February 11th, 1963, she ended her life. Who can explain why? As Sylvia had written earlier in the last optimistic pages of The Bell Jar, how did I know that someday, at college, in Europe, somewhere, anywhere, the bell jar with its stifling distortions wouldn't descend again? That bell jar out of which she had once struggled brilliantly, successfully, apparently completely, but of which she could write with the clarity of one who has endured. To the person in the bell jar, black and stopped as a dead baby, the world itself is a bad dream.